This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
There are two certainties in life. One, don't do that. And two, you dropped 150 grand on a f***ing education you could have got for $1.50 in late charges at the public library.
Adopted in 1892, the American Library Association's motto is the best reading for the largest number at the least cost. It is still the oldest and largest library organization in the world. And as technology advances, so do services public libraries provide to their communities, like access to computers and the internet. Dozens of American libraries are now becoming community maker spaces, providing access to technology like 3D printers that can be used by the public. Justin Lynch wrote about libraries as the future of manufacturing for Pacific Standard Magazine. And Justin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So libraries have become places for public access to technology. How does that fit into their whole mission?
Sure. Well, I think that public libraries have always been about providing access. In the past, they've been about access to ideas, which are found in the stacks and in books. But I think with 3D printing and 3D manufacturing, public libraries are giving access to future ideas. And I think it's an incredible change that's happening. And it is true to the core mission of libraries of giving access to everyone, whether you're the janitor like Good Will Hunting or you're the rich Harvard graduate in the bar.
Define for us exactly what is a makerspace.
Sure. Well, a makerspace can really be anything where things are made. They're kind of DIY spaces where things are made digitally. They can include things as small as one 3D printer, which costs about $2,500. And they can also include things like digital laser cutters and a whole bunch of other kinds of gadgets that you can really design anything you want. And you can customize it using 3D software and 3D modeling.
So what does it mean to turn a library into a makerspace? I imagine they become a lot noisier, for one thing.
I don't really think so. You know, I was visiting the one here in Washington, D.C., and it was incredibly amazing. It looks like this kind of Willy Wonka factory of all these machines that are operating, and they are all quite small, and they're all very quiet. And the one here in D.C. had about seven 3D printers. The one in Portsmouth only has one.
Portsmouth, New Hampshire, here.
Yeah, and they just opened up their 3D printer this past spring for the public.
What kinds of things are people making on 3D printers in libraries?
Well, the thing that I find fascinating is that you can really make anything that you can imagine. So if your car part breaks off, you can make a replacement. I drop my iPhone quite often, so I was actually looking at iPhone case designs. There's a couple in New Hampshire, and they had a patent for a backup tow navigating hitch. That's for trailers, and so it makes it easier for people to navigate with trailers while going backwards. And so they had this prototype idea, and they wanted to take it to the next step, but to make a prototype, it would have cost about $15,000, and they're not structural engineers. So instead, they went to the public library in Portsmouth, and they made a prototype for about 15 cents.
Amazing.
Yeah, and then so they had to kind of refine their idea, and their cost tripled to 45 cents. So this is the kind of thing that people are using 3D printers for their patents, for their ideas, and it's a way to boost innovation, and those barriers, things like capital and access. When libraries have 3D printers, everyone has access to it for next to nothing.
So where do they get the materials for these kind of things and the designing software and the printers themselves? What kind of investment are libraries making in those, in everything that goes into making 3D printing designs?
The materials are the only thing. that most library users have to pay, and it's incredibly cheap. Like I said, the couple in Portsmouth, they paid about 15 cents, and it was a very complex design. Most 3D printers cost about $2,500, but spaces can range up to about $250,000. That's how much the Chicago Public Library spent on theirs. And with the software, it's actually fascinating. This idea of access that has always been central to libraries is also central to all these DIY spaces. And the software is free for everyone. There's a program called Google SketchUp, which the couple in Portsmouth used. That's free for everyone. You can also go online to a website called Thingiverse.com. And it's kind of this repository of designs that anyone can just download and use themselves. So it's this idea of access that is central to this 3D manufacturing boom, which I find incredibly amazing. And just when you talk to the people there who are using this, they are all excited because they have a chance to innovate for next to nothing. And it's really great to hear them.
So how many libraries are turning themselves into makerspaces?
Well, I think the last big study found just over 100, but this past year, a lot have just started to implement libraries. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were around 150, maybe 200, because it takes about a year and a half for the full funding cycle and training cycle to really come to fruition, because libraries have to plan, they have to pitch funding for these devices, and then the librarians have to be trained on them. Mm-hmm. When I went to the Martin Luther King Jr. Library here in DC, they were kind of training by just making things, anything that they can imagine. One of them made a kind of this magical sword from a video game, and it was really incredible. And I think that's how a lot of people, when they do have access to these libraries, that's how they're learning. They're learning by doing.
Do you think this is going to be a survival strategy for libraries in this age when print is becoming more and more rare and people are going to the library less and less?
You know, I really think that this signifies the shift in library strategy as kind of a collection of resources to a place to give access for everyone. I certainly hope so. And when you see an idea or the first patent come out of a library, I think that is really going to represent everything that libraries are good for and they stand for. They're a collection of ideas to inspire you, and they will be a place where you can make these ideas. And also, library staffers are an incredible resource. They can help navigate patent law. They can help users with the internet. So I really think that 3D printing at libraries is going to fully encompass all of the skills that libraries have. And I certainly hope that it's a tool for success in the future, because libraries are essential for public learning and access.
Well, Justin, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's journalist Justin Lynch. He's also an editorial fellow at the New America Foundation, and he wrote the article, "Libraries Are the Future of Manufacturing in the United States," for Pacific Standard Magazine. Just last week, the Portsmouth Library held a public presentation of its 3D printer, which they named Gutenberg, after the inventor of the old 2D printing press. They call it Goot for short. We sent producer Megan Tan over to see the 3D printer in action. Here's her audio postcard from the visit.
Have you ever seen this before?
No, never. It's amazing.
You know what it is?
3D printer?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I love that you can, it's not hidden, that you can actually watch it. Mm-hmm.
And so we are just sending this file, basically, wirelessly to the printer. I know, it's amazing. It is mind-boggling. We've made a puzzle, which is super fun. It's actually a very challenging puzzle. And some of these were built as one piece. So this elephant, which I find fascinating, has these moving parts, but this was all one print.
Wow.
There's nothing keeping it attached.
Oh, okay, so it wasn't
pieced together
after.
Oh, right. So that is kind of interesting.
That is
this lobster tail is actually, this articulated, is actually strung together. So it was several pieces of print and then assembled. Similarly with the skull, I believe this was three parts. The teeth were two prints, obviously, and then the skull itself was one. So it's kind of interesting what comes out as one, and isn't that amazing?
What strikes me is the symmetry, that both sides are identical.
You point it over there, that's where you usually work. You mean that it could be that exact?
Yes, that it's a shadow image, in effect. One half could be turned this way, and it would still be a perfect reproduction.
So is something like a 3D printer really exciting to you?
Yes, not so much because of what I see, but I can see a huge potential for it. And this is one of these things that isn't going to stop here. It's going to be developed and extended in ways that we cannot even anticipate.
And that audio postcard was produced by Megan Tan. Some of the voices you heard belong to librarian Molly Mulligan and Portsmouth residents Sandy Jones and Joseph Jackson. You can find out more about Goot, Portsmouth 3D printer, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Scott Fallman is a computer scientist at Carnegie Mellon University, where the focus of his research is on artificial intelligence. Currently, he's working on SCONE, an open-source knowledge-based system. Now, to be honest, I have no idea what that means, and the real reason that we asked Fallman to speak with us is not his impressive career in AI, but because of something he invented in 1982 that is now used about 6 billion times a day. And this thing? This will be his legacy, no matter what else he accomplishes, and will probably be the thing that the world remembers him for. So, Scott Fallman, can you tell our listeners what it is that you are credited with inventing?
Well, back in 1982, we had very crude social media in those days. Basically, you could send email to a bulletin board where everyone could read it, and it was text-only email. And we were trying to find a way to indicate sarcastic comments, because, of course, there's no tone of voice in those kind of messages or anything like that. We didn't have any graphics, so we were trying to think what the marker should be for jokes. I'm only kidding. And I proposed colon minus parenthesis in a post to this local bulletin board, and that seems to have gone viral on us.
So you created the emoticon.
Well, I created the smiley face. A lot of people want to fight over what the first emoticon is. I think maybe it was the exclamation mark. But I proposed the colon minus parenthesis one way for smiling and the other way for frowning, and that seems to have been what caught fire and mutated and led to all these other things.
This was in 1982. You were 34, relatively new there at Carnegie Mellon. Did you have any idea what you had created?
No, we were having a stupid discussion about what would happen if the elevator went into free fall, and somebody said, okay, now due to these experiments, the elevator's been damaged, and somebody else got bent out of shape by that. And, so this was just something I tossed off in 10 minutes in the middle of that silly discussion. We didn't even save a copy. I thought it would, amuse the 10 or 20 people listening in, and that would be that.
Well, somebody has gone back to dig out a copy from September of 1982 of your proposal of the following character sequence for joke markers. And we have the colon, the minus, and the parenthesis, the smiley face. But you never got certainly paid for this, did you?
No, that's my little gift to mankind, if you... If you think about it, if it cost people 5 cents to use this or something, then nobody would use it, or if you had to get my permission. So it had to be free. I mean, there was no way to make money from it that I could see.
But do you have any regrets at all about at least not realizing that you could monetize it, as were the terms back then, to capitalize it or control it perhaps somehow?
Again, at the time, I never thought it was going to last longer than a day, and then it spread through Carnegie Mellon, and I thought, oh, this is going to last a week. And I never thought that, 33 years later, this thing would have spread around the world, morphed into these things. But I used to always say I never made a dime from this, and then somebody came up and gave me a dime, so I'd have to stop saying that. So now I just, I never made $1 million from it. And I hope somebody tried to shut me up. Yeah.
Well, you said these things. Do you not like the contemporary emoji?
I'm not crazy about the graphical ones. There was a little challenge in trying to say something amusing with just typographical characters and make, you know, different faces and characters and so on. And I think the graphics just kind of stomp on all that. You know, if they make people happy, great. You know, more power to them. Just don't send me one. The one thing I do resent is when software jumps in, and I've sent somebody a text emoticon, and the software jumps in and turns it into one of those graphical things.
Oh, right, when you do a colon. I see, right, exactly. Is there any way to prevent that? You're the computer scientist.
Yeah, well, it's one software program after another, and most of them you can disable that.
Well, Dr. Vollmann, I started this conversation talking about your legacy. Does it bother you that you're going to be remembered or talked to or about the emoticon?
Well, you know, this was 10 silly minutes of my life 34 years ago, and it's kind of weird that this is probably the most famous thing I'll ever do, even if I make major inroads into the study of artificial intelligence. However, it's kind of fun to be something, to be a little bit famous for something. You know, it's been a fun ride. I've been invited to places to give talks on this, and some of them have been fun places. I've met a lot of people. If I'm going to be remembered for something completely trivial, at least it's a happy something trivial.
Well, it does seem to like history remembers a good story. So is the creation of the smiley face just a better story or maybe easier story to tell than that of your work in artificial intelligence?
Yeah, it takes me a little while to explain what I'm doing in AI, and it depends on the educational level of who's listening and, you know, how much they know about computers to begin with.
Okay, so assume that I'm a third grader in science.
Okay.
What would you like to tell me about SCONE, the program that you are working on?
Well, what I've been doing pretty much my whole career is trying to get some kind of common sense into these systems. So they're AI systems that do impressive things. But they're mostly things people go away to college to learn, you know, chess and solving complex linear equations, and nonlinear equations, and solving chemistry problems and so on. But we still don't have intelligent programs that know what a table and a chair is and that you sit on one and you're supposed to, you know, put stuff on the other, maybe eat from it. That it's a good idea to open a door before you go through it, which we have to tell the robots. So what all people have by the time they're, you know, 5 years old or certainly 10 is this huge store of knowledge about the world. You know, different jobs, different kinds of people. What are the rules for talking to your elders? And that differs from one culture to another, which you learn later. So there's, when we say common sense, it's really all the knowledge we have in common. But you can't just plug in Wikipedia to an AI system and have that be good enough, because the knowledge has to get into the game. It has to play a role in all your thinking, and it has to be accessible to you when it's needed and not get in your face the rest of the time.
You spent a
so
lot.
So I'm trying to build a system that will support that and people can use and put into their various AI programs or even not AI programs and make them more sensible, easier to deal with, and we're trying to get them to understand natural language, you know, simple English.
You've been working at this for a long time. Do you think you'll see that, realize it in your lifetime?
Well, it depends on my funding, but yeah.
Well, I actually read something about your funding, that it's about to expire. Now, what does that mean and
what
then
well,
is next?
The current grant we're on is about to expire, and we're talking with those folks about maybe the next grant. But it depends if the government gets shut down and all of those things. This is mostly federal research money.
Don't they know who you are?
Well, there are a lot of smart people working in this field, and right now this is not the most fashionable kind of research. Everybody's working on machine learning and big data, you may have heard about. The kind of AI I'm working on is just what people can do. You know, a lot of the field is off doing all these things that no human can actually do, and I'm trying to get the stuff that every normal person just does without even thinking about it.
You said earlier it's nice to be a little bit famous. Is it better than to be in the history books for something you're not entirely proud of or take complete ownership of than to be left out of them entirely?
Well, it's my goal to be in the history book for something else also, you know, which is why I'm still working at this. I'd like to make some real inroads into artificial intelligence and make some lasting difference in the field. I've done some things that are, you know, of some value to the field, but I think what I'm working on now is maybe the big home run.
To that I say, colon, minus, parentheses.
Which kind of parenthesis?
The parenthesis that looks happy.
Okay, that's good.
Dr. Scott Fahlman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Right, thank you.
Scott Fahlman, he's a research professor at Carnegie Mellon University and inventor of that little smiley face that became the emoji. You can read a portrait of him from Narratively. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Honeybees have been dying off in startling numbers over the past decade, many from something called colony collapse disorder. While researchers continue to look for root causes and cures for what's killing off these essential pollinators, an 18-year-old from Philadelphia is creating a high-tech hive to monitor the health of his bees. Todd Bookman brings us the story.
There's something of an urban farm in Wingiri's backyard, lots of flowers and wildlife, and for the past few years, honeybees. Back in the far right corner of the property is a workbench covered with the mess that comes when you try to install the guts of a computer into a beehive.
It's about a foot and a half high. We've taken all of the frames out of it, which are the frames that the bees build off of. It's what you see that has all of the wax built up on it, all the like honeycomb shaped stuff. So we've taken all of that out actually, and so now it's just an empty box with cables and wires and lights and cameras and stuff inside of it.
Once it's assembled, the box will stack onto one of Wynn's hives. If you've never seen one, man-made hives look like bedroom furniture, kind of like a chest of drawers with a little entrance on the front. All of the wires and sensors and cameras and microphones will hopefully shed some new light on what's going on inside the hive, and perhaps in the larger environment.
I went into the project being like, I want to solve colony collapse disorder, which is kind of funny coming from a kid my age, but we've kind of, the project's morphed a little bit, especially as I've talked to Max. It's kind of like, let's go in there, let's put these sensors in, and like, let's see if we learn something new.
Max is Max Lawrence, a 40-year-old artist who works with technology, and who at times comes off as less mature than teenage Wynn. And I mean that as sort of a compliment to both of them. They met at the Department of Making and Doing. It's a makerspace in West Philly. Wynn brought the bee knowledge, Max the tech know-how. Still, that combination hasn't made it easy to get this thing up and running.
I'm not really sure, man. It could be like 20 minutes. It could be 4 hours. It could potentially be next week. I mean, I'd like to say it's not, but like, I got limits.
There's a bit of a crunch here because Wynn leaves for college at the Rhode Island School of Design in a few weeks. He's hoping to monitor the bees from there, not just be able to watch a live stream over the internet, but actually track the smallest details of their lives.
In addition to the camera, we've got alcohol sensors, methane sensors, humidity, temperature, noise level.
Plus carbon monoxide and dust sensors, all this gadgetry tucked into the corner of the hive. Wynn says it will beam out a pretty sophisticated stream of data.
For a little while there, I was saying that we were going to have the most advanced smart beehive in the world, which I still don't think is untrue, but at least at a hobbyist level, we will. I don't know what, you know, research universities and stuff are doing, but we're going to have a pretty intense setup here.
Turns out research universities are doing similar projects. In fact, everyone from the USDA to Greenpeace to Monsanto are paying attention. Honeybees play a huge role in our food system. They pollinate crops, including lots of nuts, berries, fruits, and vegetables. So struggling bee colonies put huge economic uncertainty onto the shoulders of farmers, both large and small. Backyard and rooftop enthusiasts are also under strain.
We've really struggled, and a lot of hobbyist beekeepers are really struggling. So last winter was our worst winter yet. We had one hive survive of the four that we had last summer.
There's a good chance some of his new hives will die off again this winter. There have been years when 60% of hives in Pennsylvania failed. And so for Wynn, the idea here is that if he's got all this data, perhaps he can zero in on what forces are at play. But unlike research universities and government agencies, he and Max are trying to build the smart hive on less than $500. And while they're knowledgeable, they're not exactly experts.
Because everybody makes it sound so simple. They're like, oh yeah, just put it on the internet. And trying to get a data feed and video to stream real time out by a beehive through the firewalls of insert name of company there and the router settings, and then like everybody wants you to buy something so you have another plugin. It's just terrifying. Like the baby cam, I keep going back to looking at being like, how do they make it work? You know, like what is, should I just buy an iPhone and shove the iPhone in the beehive? Yeah, now looking back, probably shoulda. Like wouldn't have known that if it weren't for the experience of doing it, you know?
While Max tinkers with an infrared lens, Wynn throws on a bee suit and pulls the veil down over his Buddy Holly glasses. He uses a stainless steel canister to shoot puffs of smoke at the bees. This calms them down as he cracks open the hive. The smoke technique, and really a lot of beekeeping techniques, haven't changed much over the years. Even the furniture-looking hive has been around since the 1850s. That's when a pastor from Philadelphia named L.L. Langstroth figured out this was the easiest way to harvest honey.
So Langstroth was born down on Front Street in Philadelphia, and he spent his life kind of designing the beehive. And so Philadelphia is known as the cradle of American beekeeping because the Langstroth beehive was actually invented over in Germantown. So it's kind of really cool to be working on such kind of an innovative project in the same city where modern-day beekeeping started.
Inside the hive, the female worker bees are going about their business, as they have for millions and millions of years, each carrying out a task to keep the hive up and running.
You have a lot of respect for what the bees are doing in here, and how organized everything is.
That organization makes it a good target for data collection. The bees tend to follow patterns, so it'll be easy, in theory at least, to see when those activities change. There's also another well-known aspect of life inside the hive that they want to study.
Another fantasy of Wynn and I is to be able to identify inside of the colony when the bee does a waggle dance. The waggle dance is when the bee shakes its butt and lets the other bees know where there's, syrupy goodness like Mountain Dew or like...
So the waggle dance is like a semicircular dance with a little zigzag through the middle. And so the direction that the bee's pointing tells the other bees which direction a good amount of flowers is, and the number of waggles is, or the number of zigzags, tells the bees how far. So this like magic communicational dance that these bees do let all of the other bees know where the flowers are, where the nectar is.
They want to use image recognition software, like Facebook uses, to digitally track the waggle dance, measure angles and movement, and create an interactive map detailing where the bees are foraging. It's the perfect marriage of nature and technology, at least in Max's head.
To be able to have that streams, those streams of data, to be able to manipulate and reintroduce to each other and recontextualize, it's a paintbrush on some like Bob Ross, like happy bee accident. You know what I mean? Like throw it together, see what sticks. And if it doesn't stick, don't be so occupied with what you expect out of it, because that's bad science.
It's taken Max and Wynn 9 months to get where they are right now, but where they are right now is actually pretty good. The sensors are finally up and running and collecting data, which they're going to make public, and the infrared video feed is streaming a close-up look at life inside the smart hive. It is scary and awesome and transfixing. When Wynn leaves for school, his bees will be virtually there with him. And when some of them die this winter, as the odds suggest they will, he'll be watching too, and perhaps learning what's to blame. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
An outbreak of avian flu has sent egg prices steadily upward in the past few months. At least 40 million chickens have had to be killed by U.S. farmers. Fewer chickens means fewer eggs and higher prices for the consumer. At an average price of $2.49 a dozen, that is twice what a carton costs in April or May. But what if you had your own private supply of eggs? Enter the rental chicken. Jen Tompkins and her husband Phil are homesteaders and co-founders of RentTheChicken.com. They provide customers who may never have considered chicken farming in the past a new option to have fresh eggs in their own backyard. Jen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
Well, how did you come up with this idea of renting chickens?
We were planning for the future, which in our case, the future was just in a couple months. We knew that my temporary part-time job was coming to an end for a research study program. And I knew that I did not want to go back to a regular 8:30 to 5 job at a desk. And so we started looking around for at-home businesses. And there was crazy business ideas out there that included renting chickens. And we had some chickens of our own, and I'm pretty handy with some power tools. So I said, oh, I can build a couple coops, rent some chickens. So Rent the Chicken was hatched.
Of course it was. What does the rental fee include?
So we have rental periods from 4 to 6 months. It includes a portable chicken coop, either 2 or 4 egg-laying hens. We provide feed for the rental period. Delivery is free within 50 miles from any of our affiliates.
So this is about $400, depending on your location, for that package that you spoke of. Are people expected to sell eggs and actually make money off of eggs?
No, they are just using the chicken rentals to have eggs for their family. The standard rental package provides 2 hens, and they produce about 1 dozen eggs a week. And the deluxe package comes with 4 chickens, and they produce about 2 dozen eggs a week.
Have you noticed an uptick in business since the cost of eggs has gone up?
We have calls all the time. So we believe that it's not just about the cost of eggs, it's not just about the bird flu, but it's about people really wanting to know where one single food source comes from. So I think that there's multiple factors that's involved as to why people want to have some backyard chickens. And not everybody knows how to do it. Like 50 years ago, either you had chickens or you knew somebody who had chickens in their backyard and that's where you got your eggs from. But now everybody buys their eggs at the store unless you are one of the few who has your own chickens or you know somebody who raises chickens and you get your eggs from there. So we're really trying to help people get back to some roots. There's a generation gap. Know where some food sources are coming from. Not everything comes from styrofoam or from the grocery store.
There is an option to buy the chickens at the end of the rental term, a kind of a rent-to-owner leasing. Do many people take you up on that option?
Yes, we call it adoption. And we do have many people who do adopt. And what we also have some people participate in is that we bring their chickens back at the end of the rental season, and then they can rent again 6 months later when rentals start again.
Oh, they can get like all fresh chickens, you're saying?
We earmark them, for the lack of a better term, and we keep their chickens, and then they get the same chickens the following year because they're very attached to Anna and Elsa or Laverne and Shirley. Mm.
Well, I was just recently speaking with a friend in Vermont who has had 8 of her chickens killed by foxes. What happens if something happens to the chickens under the renter's watch?
That is very unfortunate, to be honest. So let's say it does happen. If a predator gets into one of our chicken coops and the chicken coop was secure and the renter has done everything they're supposed to do, we will replace the chicken and apologize and we will make it right. Now, if the chicken was outside, the renter comes home from the grocery store, their chickens have been free ranging without supervision, and all they find is a pile of feathers, then we are going to talk to them again about unsupervised free-range time. And there is a fee to replace those chickens.
So you say a portable chicken coop. How big can that be?
Our coops are about 3.5 feet wide by 5.5 feet long. And there are wheels on one end. So it moves like a wheelbarrow. You lift one end up and move it. And we recommend that they move it the length of the coop so that the chickens are they have access to fresh grass and bugs, but it also allows the renter to not have a buildup of droppings, which cause an odor.
So they'll also have a lot more space than they would have in a commercial centralized feeding operation.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, on your Facebook page, I saw that some of your chickens have actually made it to Broadway. First, tell us more. And are there plans to expand your rental services to Hollywood?
That is so funny. We received a call one day and the gentleman said, listen, we need a couple of chickens for our Broadway production. Penn and Teller's coming from Vegas to Broadway for a 7-week show and we need chickens for them. And I said, holy cow. Like, I'm pretty sure that's my response. But in my professional way, I said, we would be happy to service your chicken needs. And so we did. We have an affiliate in central Pennsylvania who was willing to make the trip and drop off the chickens. We did negotiate a deal, which included some free tickets for the show. our affiliate did go see the show and she was so super stoked. She got to meet them after the show and everything. I will say that there are chickens and a cow involved in that skit.
Okay, will you confirm, however, that no chickens were harmed during the production?
No, because those same chickens are used for every show. So there's no harm done to the chickens in the production.
Well, good to know. Jen, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jen Tompkins is co-founder of RentTheChicken.com. You'll find a link to find out more about rental chickens at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few years back, a handful of guys started a cooking/comedy sketch show on YouTube called Epic Mealtime. Their shtick? To create ridiculously indulgent meals like Four Loko chili, candy pizza, and fast food lasagna.
15 Big Macs, 15 Baconators, 15 Team Burgers, no veggies, custom Jack Daniel's meat sauce. Pack your little brain.
Fast forward to 2015, and Epic Mealtime boasts nearly 7 million subscribers, a cookbook, merchandising, and the show sounds suspiciously like an actual cooking program.
So it's like 4 in the morning, I'm going through the freezer and I found jalapeno poppers. Naturally, the evolution of that is to wrap them in bacon. Then I decided, I want to make a sandwich. Jalapeno popper bread was born. Got our Black Label jalapeno thick cut bacon that we're gonna chop into small bits.
Epic Mealtime is just one of many YouTube cooking shows that is challenging the status quo of foodie TV by pitting amateurs and hobbyists up against the likes of Wolfgang Puck and Rachel Ray. Neil Ungerleiter is a writer at Fast Company, where he recently wrote about the trend. Neil, great to have you with us on Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia. Great to be here.
How popular are YouTube cooking shows like this?
They're popular. One thing I found that was crazy is for one show, My Cupcake Addiction, they have 2 million subscribers who just get updates of every single new video their host makes. And they're not just popular, they're profitable. This cupcake show makes reportedly $60,000 each month in advertising. And I've encountered other shows that make as much as $120,000 each month in advertising money just off YouTube. It's incredible.
$60,000, $120,000 a month just through ads on YouTube?
People love watching YouTube cooking shows. You just mentioned Epic Mealtime, and their viewership is massive. And it's people who don't normally watch cooking shows. It's people who just want to make ridiculous recipes for parties or just to be entertained. And because YouTube videos are shorter, they're 4 minutes long, 15 minutes long, whatever the case may be, they're at an advantage for actually showing recipes, showing cooking, as opposed to a 22-minute cable TV show.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting from your article more than 11.5 billion views on YouTube's cooking vertical, about 118,000 channels. Now, how do those views stack up compared to the traditional cooking shows, the Wolfgang Pucks or Anthony Bourdain?
They stack up extremely, extremely favorably. So to give one example, Anthony Bourdain's show No Reservations only had 8.1 million views on YouTube, while Epic Mealtime had 774 million views.
Oh my gosh.
And it's really something. And also the important thing for advertisers, who are the people pouring in money that makes the whole thing going, is these videos you can bring up any single time you're cooking a dish, mm-hmm. any time you want to make this meal you saw on YouTube. You can watch this video again and again. That's not something you can do for, say, Alton Brown or Rachel Ray.
Let's hear a clip. This is from another one of the shows mentioned in your article. This is Nerdy Nummies.
Hello, it's Ro. Today on Nerdy Nummies, I'm here with... Da-na-na-na-na! I'm making a rainbow with Courtney. We are making what kind of cake today?
Rainbow.
Magic unicorn. Somebody requested. They wanted this. They wanted Courtney and I to make them a rainbow magic unicorn cake. So we...
Rainbow magic unicorns. Nerdy Nummies there. Funny how accustomed we are to really watching cooks function in these high-end kitchen sets with the best equipment. The girls from Nerdy Nummies look like they're cooking in a college dorm, you know, or apartment kitchenette. Is that part of the charm?
It's part of the charm. There are videos where people cook in their dorm rooms. I saw one video. It was actually folks working on a merchant tanker showing how they make food on a hot plate for their team. And it's very, very do-it-yourself, very democratic. And Rosanna Panzino, the host of Nerdy Nummies, she started this show shortly after she moved to L.A. to break into the entertainment industry. And for her, it was a hobby. It was something for her to do to get her name out, kind of dip her toes in the waters while looking for roles on TV. And now suddenly she has a cookbook contract, and the cookbook, which isn't even on sale yet, it's the number one pre-seller on Amazon for cookbooks. It's incredible.
Wow. Any idea whether these upstarts, given their popularity, are a real threat to the conventional cooking shows, or they're reaching completely different audiences?
They reach different audiences, and one thing I think really matters for YouTube cooking shows is if you're cooking for celiac disease, for veganism, any sort of conditions, you can make this thrive on YouTube and have viewers, which for cable TV, which has to reach massive audiences, sometimes has a bit more trouble with. And there is a YouTube cooking network called TasteMade that works with creators, gives them funding, studios, logistical assistance, whatever the case may be, that's actually funded by Comcast and by Scripps Network, which is the parent company of the Food Network and the Cooking Channel. These old guard cable companies see the future as being in YouTube for cooking videos.
Hmm. That's interesting, because I was going to ask if programs like Nerdy Nummies Epic Mealtime might be looking to make a transition to the more traditional mediums of cable television cooking shows. Sounds like they might be going the other way.
They could be, and I wouldn't be surprised if they did. But from a business standpoint, it might not make sense for them to do that. Mm. It might make more sense for them to stay on the computer, on the phone, on the tablet, and not on cable TV, which really, I mean, I'm used to the Food Network. That really shocks me.
Well, Neil Ungerleiter, another universe you've opened up for us. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Neil Ungerleiter, he's a writer for Fast Company, and you can find links to his article and see some of the YouTube cooking shows that we mentioned. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org.
Good day, welcome to Charlie's Crafty Kitchen. Today we're making watermelon popsicles! Yay!
Thank you so much for your listening time today. If hearing about smart hives, chicken rental programs, and YouTube cooking channels whet your appetite for a second helping, there's a lot more to discover at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also subscribe to our All You Can Eat Buffet, also known as our podcast, by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you're satisfied, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.